This way, ma'am.
I must say, this checkered marble floor is very impressive. It makes me feel like we're on a giant chessboard. Latimer, we're not on a giant chessboard, are we?
No, ma'am. If you would care to look up, you will see the vaulted ceiling of the checkered palace above us. In any case, there are far too many squares for a chessboard.
I can see now why you suggested I wear this black and white dress.
Indeed, ma'am. It's also why I have avoided any splashes of colour myself.
Latimer, you never wear anything colourful.
Except on my day off, ma'am.
I thought we weren't going to talk about that.
Very good, ma'am.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't had Daredevil spoiled before you've had a chance to finish watching it. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Well, this palace is quite remarkable. Though I must confess it is rather strange being in a place without any colour. Even outside, with all the snow and winter trees, there's no colour out there either. Oh well, at least the cushions on these chairs are plump, and there's enough room for everyone.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Miss Sarah McIntyre.
Oh, splendid. Let's see her calling card.
Do take care, ma'am. It appears to have been printed on the hide of a small Muppet.
Oh, Latimer, that's just a googly eye.
But what about the fur, ma'am?
One tiny tuft of hot pink fur does not a Muppet make. Sarah McIntyre, illustratrix. I write and make pictures for books and comics. Splendid. Send her in. For those of you who don't know, Sarah McIntyre is an award-winning illustrator, writer, and comic creator. Her comic Vernon Lettuce appeared weekly in The Guardian, and her comic strip Shark and Unicorn runs 6 times a year in the Funday Times. She has collaborated with author Philip Reeve on the marvellous Oliver and the Seawigs and Cakes in Space.
Ms. Sarah McIntyre, ma'am.
Hello, Sarah. It's so lovely to see you. Please do come and sit down. How are you?
Oh, very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. May I compliment you on your astounding outfit?
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And may I compliment you on your astounding palace here? This is amazing.
Yes, isn't it something incredible? Sadly, it's not actually mine. We're borrowing it from a friend. But
good to have these sorts of friends.
It is. Well, yes and no, depending on it. Well, let's not go into the details, shall we? I've learnt not to ask Latimer about these strange friends he has. And things generally go more smoothly when I don't. But anyway, I have to ask, is that actually a working orrery in your hat?
There is. I popped up to the Royal Observatory the other day and they fitted me up with one. And all the planets go around exactly as they do in real life.
That is absolutely extraordinary.
It is rather amazing.
It is, and it's also one of my nemesis words, orrery. It's a bit tricky. It's like my kind of audiobook narrator's kryptonite.
They're so hard to travel with when you put them in suitcases. They stick out in all directions.
Yes, and this cape. Those are feathers, aren't they? Real thousands of feathers from exotic birds, I assume.
They are. But none of them actually plucked from birds. They're all from the forest floor, I must assure you.
Oh, good. I did worry.
Yeah, all picked up by animal rights activists. It's all right.
Oh, good. Oh, that's all right then. Well, phew. Well, would you care for some tea?
Why, thank you. I would. Yes, please.
And how do you take your tea?
Ooh, extra strong, but with lots of milk as well, please.
Ah, you see, I am so delighted. So many of my friends who come to tea know just exactly how to take it. So I will pour. And I was wondering if you would like a slice of cherry Madeira cake.
Oh, go on then. That looks fabulous. I love the icing on it. It's amazing. I didn't know they're usually iced, but that one is just beautifully done.
Yes, yes. Well, I think Latimer wanted to keep within the theme of the black and white checkerboard. I did wonder what sort of cake it was, but he assures me it's a cherry Madeira inside. Oh, yes, and there we can see some of the cherries. They look nice and plump. Don't mind the chickens over there. They won't bother you. You don't mind chickens, do you? I assume not, seeing as you have a fabulous feather cape.
No, not at all, as long as they're not offended.
They don't seem to be. They seem to be fairly relaxed, which is just as well, considering how much we travel. Right. So in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
Actually, can I go out and get him? He's waiting in the corridor. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'll be one moment. Right, here he is. Here he is. This is Kevin, the Dartmoor Pegasus.
Oh, wow!
Oh, sorry, he's flying. Kevin, you've got to come down. You can't fly off. You have to stay on the floor. Sorry. Sorry, the chickens.
No, it's fine.
The chickens are everywhere. I'm sorry. He's distracting the chickens.
Oh, no, it's fine. Kevin. No, it's, Kevin, feel free to stay up high. It's a very high ceiling. I'm delighted to meet Kevin in person. I've seen the illustrations on your website, which I adore.
If you'd come down, you could actually meet him properly.
He's so deliciously plump.
He is. He's just bobbing above our heads. Kevin, sit down. Okay, there we go. Here's Kevin. He's very polite, isn't he, Kevin?
Hello, Kevin. I was wondering, is it custard creams that are his favourite biscuit?
Yes, he loves custard. In fact, he loves every biscuit, but custard creams, people bring them specially when he's on Dartmoor, because they know he likes them.
Oh, marvellous. I'll Latimer, could you get some custard creams, please? Marvellous. So we'll give him some custard creams, and hopefully he'll be happy whilst we take our tea. And, maybe I should move the cake.
Yeah, he's already eating the cake. He likes the
cake. We mustn't let Latimer see that. He might get upset. So one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, obviously you are a very established illustrator, and you've been doing this for a long time. One of the things that people talk about in terms of writers is discovering your author voice. Developing all that kind of stuff. And lots of people, myself included, find it very hard to define exactly what that is. I was wondering if there's an equivalent for illustrators.
Yes, I think there is. I mean, it's a little bit different because sort of illustration, it's not second to the words, but it's second to the story itself. So, people talk about a style, but a lot of times you kind of adapt your technique and adapt your materials to suit a certain story. You know, you might need to tell a story a bit differently. So people might say, oh, why did you change your style for that book? And you think, well, because the story was important and that was the style that was needed. So I think my work does have like an overall style, but also, you kind of use what works. Like with Jampires, I used all pencil and I tried to get a sort of very tactile, scratchy feel to it in a way. Whereas a lot of other books I'll use watercolor and I'm trying to be just more bright and in your face, I guess. Sometimes I think I'd like to get a much more kicked back style. And I look at sort of minimalist illustrations and think, oh, it would be so much easier to do it that way.
So did you set out to try and find your own style and then realize you adapt to each project? Or is it something which has just been totally organic?
I think it's organic because I have ideas of what I would like. But when I actually do it, it's, it just comes out the way it comes out. And you never quite know exactly how it's going to look until you put it on the page. And it builds itself. And I don't know, I can't compare the things I liked as a kid. I really liked sort of lots of detail and lots of color. And when I tried to be a bit more kicked back, it looked empty to me. And I think it was the same. I used to run an art gallery with some friends, and there was a lot of minimalist artwork. It was very fashionable, no color. And I just thought, this isn't me. I can't really do that. I'm a maximalist, I'm afraid.
A maximalist. I like that. I think we should ascribe that to our outfits as well. Maximalist outfits. Yes. Now, speaking of your outfits, I have to ask, where do you get your fabulous hats?
They're kind of a mix, actually. I get some at charity shops and secondhand shops, and How do they ever buy them new? Because, you know, you can pay £10 in a charity shop and £1,000 in a shop, in a regular shop. So either I make them from things I find often at the pound shop, or I sew on bits of hats that I found that aren't so pretty and add, you know, just build them like you'd build, like you'd dice a cake, really.
There's something that I keep thinking that I want to experiment with, because I do the coats and the dresses, but the hats, I'm not so sure. I don't feel confident about. And some of the things I've been looking at over the past year, the 1950s style, which is really appealing to me at the moment, the things they used to do with just like little tiny bits of hat and net that just finish off the outfit was just so gorgeous.
Oh, it's beautiful. The thing is, I started wearing those sort of hats, and then they kind of seemed a bit small after a while. Bigger and bigger. 50s hats, and then I add massive feathers or extra sort of twill, what do you call it? That netty stuff.
There's tulle, T-U-L-L-E. I wondered if it's a similar thing for you, but obviously we both have elements of our jobs. It's quite strange in that we have a job which requires us to be by ourselves creating things a lot of the time. And then the other end of the scale, we have to go out into public and do things. And we both create outfits to wear for public events. And certainly in terms of my reasoning behind that is that if I make something that's kind of larger than my normal life and kind of more, I don't know what the word is, exotic sounds wrong because that, you know, suggests sparkly bikini, but it's kind of, you know what I mean, kind of more dramatic than normal everyday like tracksuit bottoms that I normally wear and tatty jumpers, that it's a way of kind of hiding behind those outfits so I can cope with being in public. Is there an element of that for you, or is it all theatre?
Yeah, I think it's sort of when you go into a like a green room at a festival and there's somebody, you know, you think is amazing there. Or maybe you're a very famous person, but you feel embarrassed because you don't actually know their books very well. And you go in. But if you have the most fabulous outfit and you sweep in, you end up having a good conversation with them because you just end up talking about, you know, whatever's on your hat or something silly. Or they end up trying on your hat. Oh, like when Margaret Atwood was at the Edinburgh Festival and she tried to get me to come over with my wig so she could take selfies with it. That was fabulous, because what was I going to say to Margaret Atwood? I mean, I love her books, but everyone says I love your books. So, but also I think when you go to schools, especially when I do school with events with kids, it's kind of a way of just getting their attention. And because if you walk in looking like one of their mums, they think, oh, who's this supply teacher? You know, but if you go in looking absolutely fantastic, then they kind of, their mouths drop open and they think, you know, is this some superstar? Is this Lady Gaga? Who is this? They love it. So you get their attention and actually they get more out of it in the end.
I wonder if also it's the same for you that when I go to a convention and I change out of my civvies, which is my military family background coming out there, I change out of my normal clothes and put on my outfits. It's like a mental shift. It's almost like going to work in an odd way, like putting not a uniform per se, but it gets me into a different mindset like a costume would if I was in a live role-playing event, where I'm still myself, but in a different mindset. Do you find that it has a psychological impact like that for you?
Very much so. You're in work mode. You're ready to be on. And I'm quite introverted and shy and quiet. But when I put my clothes on, you know, I am on. I'm ready. I'm ready to talk to people. I think, you know, it's just, yeah, it's a different mindset. It is like wearing, you know, a military outfit.
Yeah, it's really interesting talking to somebody else who has this, because it's different to cosplay, where you're kind of dressing as an established character. You're kind of dressing as yourself as the character, but not, and it's really hard to describe.
People say that, they say, you know, who are you dressed in? It's like, well, me, aren't I allowed to just be my own unique person?
Yes.
It's fun,
yes.
I love it. Oh, I love it when kids dress up as my characters too from my books. Like, you'll get a vampire or Iris the Mermaid or someone, and it's wonderful. I love that. I'm a big cosplay fan.
Yes, oh, me too. It's funny you mention Iris the Mermaid, because my next question was about her. There's somebody who lives in my household who's very interested to know whether Iris the Mermaid will be coming back in any other stories.
I don't know, because when we set out, when Philip Reeve and I set out with Oxford University Press to do four books, we could have done a series, but we thought, no, we want to have fun. This is our first time working together. We want to try different things, you know, create four different worlds. And they're kind of linked because they're all adventure stories. But no, we thought it was tempting to go back to that Sea Wigs story just because people loved the sea monkeys so much and the mermaids and things. And we thought, no, let's press on. Let's get to do four books and then we can maybe think about going back if we want to.
If you had to sacrifice one colour to save the world, which would it be and why?
Honestly, I don't know. That I love the thing is when you're young, you hate certain colours because they remind you of, like, I didn't like beige because our hospital corridors were beige, and I didn't like puce because military uniforms were kind of puce. But now I sort of love them, you know, because they set off the other colours. So I guess beige, but. I secretly love beige too.
Poor beige.
I'd say magnolia. I think too many people paint their houses magnolia when it could be like bright yellow or bright orange or green or something. So yeah, magnolia.
Yes, I would like to second that actually. The house we lived in before this one, which we were never fully happy in, was all magnolia. And just even now, going into places which are all magnolia, it just makes me feel slightly ill because of that association. Ugh, horrible.
Oh, there's also lemon yellow. I mean, I've seen some very badly painted lemon yellow kitchens. They make everyone look a bit ill. So in Taspex, I would say lemon yellow.
So I'd like you to imagine that your taste buds have developed a superpower and you could suddenly taste one of the following things and you need to choose which one you would want to be able to taste. Would it be injustice, love, or the need to break wind in public?
So I would be able to taste these things.
Only one of them. Which one would you choose?
Wait, so I would actually be able to taste the need to break wind in public?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it would taste like. Probably quite unpleasant, but I imagine injustice would taste worse.
So somebody offers you a plate of biscuits and you taste one and you think, oh, this tastes awfully like that person needed to break wind in public.
Yes, you would know. You would know. Can you imagine what it would be like to travel on the London Underground? You would just permanently have a terrible taste in your mouth. So I'm assuming you don't want to pick that one.
I think I'd rather taste love of all those.
Yeah, let's hope that love doesn't taste horrible, because then every time you're in love, or yeah, there was love around you, if there was a taste.
If injustice tastes like coffee, walnut cake, I would like lots of injustice, please.
I'm not sure that's how it would work. I need to think about this more carefully, obviously. I have one last question, which is actually from the Twitters, because I like to ask people on Twitter if they have a question for someone that I'm about to take tea with. And one jumped out at me, that they'd like me to ask you what your favourite mug or cup is and why.
Yeah, here's one right here. I've got it in my handbag, and it's one I designed for the Cuddy Sark Clipper ship. And I used to be the ship's illustrator before I went on to do Oliver the Sea Wigs and Kicks in Space and everything. So Cuddy Sark kind of sailing around the edge of the cup. And inside there's a cat sort of trying to catch the ship's mouse. I tried to get a job there once when I was... I had a bit of a crisis of work, and so I actually interviewed Bea Rigger, but they hired me as their illustrator instead.
Would you have preferred to be a rigger?
Well, it was a 12-year commitment, so it would have been quite a change of career, but I would have got to travel around the world, you know, fixing masted ships, which would have been cool, actually.
Yeah, that would certainly be very different. I understand you have a new picture book coming out in May. Am I right in thinking it's Dinosaur Police?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's about a T-Rex who goes on the rampage in a pizza factory, and he's eating lots of pizzas, and the police, who are dinosaurs, everyone in the world is dinosaurs, they have to catch him. It was really fun designing a dinosaur world, and it's a little bit Mediterranean, actually. It doesn't look like the Flintstones or anything. It's very civilized dinosaur world. And they have, you know, a bakery and hat shops and things like that. Very important things.
It sounds great. Which kind of age group is that aimed at?
I think picture books are kind of for everyone, but I think, you know, anyone that can hold a book, from little babies to grown up, really. I think probably a 2-year-old, 3-year-old could sort of read along a little bit with a parent. I don't know. I mean, I love picture books and I'm a grown up, so I don't think there is an age group for them.
And that's one of the things that we found reading Oliver and the Sea Wigs and Cakes in Space with our little boy, that it's just as enjoyable for us as it is for him, and he loves them. Because, of course, Cakes in Space is the latest one, isn't it, that you've brought out with Philip Reeve?
That's right. With Cakes in Space, it was supposed to be kind of seven and upward, but I found children as young as, you know, three like it when the parents are reading it to them as a bedtime story.
I have a confession to make in that my son wanted to dress up as Pilbeam for World Book Day, and I said no because I just... I feel so bad, but he said it like... I am a terrible mother, and it was like 3 days before, and we have quite a lot of stuff going on in our life at the moment, and I said, I'm really sorry, darling, I don't know how I can make a Pilbeam outfit in 3 days, whilst not in the best of health. So one day I have to make him a Pilbeam outfit.
That's not the easiest outfit to make.
No, no, not at all. One of the things I've been really impressed with, because obviously I follow you on Twitter, is the Pictures Mean Business campaign. Have you seen a lot of kind of feedback about that from the industry? Because it's about illustrators gaining professional recognition on a par with writers. Have you seen any kind of feedback from Nielsen and places like that about what you've been talking about?
Well, we're still kind of researching it because, to be honest, I'm like most illustrators, and I've never actually used Nielsen, so I don't know much about how it works. And so Charlotte Eyre, the bookseller, and my agent are looking into the kind of ins and outs of Nielsen. And it's partly the problem with Nielsen and partly the publishers who don't fill in all the relevant information on a book. So we're trying to sort of figure out who's most responsible and, you know, how to encourage publishers to include the name of their illustrators. It's all about metadata, which is this buzzword in the industry. And publishers, when they put in the kind of the metadata about their book, they include the writers, the illustrators, and the translators.
I hope it does well, because it does sound like a complete injustice to have the writers mentioned more than the illustrators when it is a true collaboration.
It is strange. You know, a picture book, you think that, you know, the writer has, you know, many times, and the illustrator spent a week on every page, and, you know, it's a lavish illustration, and then they say, you know, by the writer, and don't mention the illustrator, and you think, especially in reviews by book people, and you think, come on, book people, you're our people, you should be on our team.
Yeah, definitely.
When I bring up the subject, people are like, oh, of course, it's just that they don't think of it. So it's trying to kind of gently remind people, saying, you know, just remember, it's not just because of the illustrators wanting attention. It's partly, you know, they need it for work to be able to build the profile professionally. And also, it's also good for the kids, because kids get inspired by illustrators as much as writers, sometimes more. They love to watch people drawing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's accessible before words are accessible, after all.
Exactly, yeah. And it's, you know, people are so into it. It's very friendly. But I think a lot of illustrators are afraid to speak up because they don't want to be branded as difficult and therefore, you know, not get work or not get reviews. So it is a little bit slightly nerve-wracking. You think, and also people will contact me saying, could you please flag this situation? They're too scared to. I hope this isn't going to do me too much damage career-wise. We'll see. But it does need to happen. We need the change. And if I can't get credited for my work, you know, I won't get more work. And, you know, it's not, if we still want to have our work, we need to change this situation, because it's getting worse, because everything's so reliant on metadata right now.
Something I like to ask my friends when they come to tea, something that could be considered a strange question, but it's all to do with the chickens over there who are actually magnificent singers. You wouldn't believe it to look at them, but they seem to know everything that we've asked them to sing. So I'd like to ask you, if you had to pick a theme tune for your life, which would you pick?
Ooh, I think it's difficult. I think the thing that's probably the most realistic, there's a thing in Pride and Prejudice when Mary Bennett is sitting at the piano and she's singing this parlor version of an opera from Things by Handel, and she does it very, very badly. It's exactly how I sort of go on through life. You know, you just do it badly. And it's funny because I went to the opera and heard it sung, you know, beautifully by a countertenor, and I thought, oh, it's Mary's song. I like the fact that it's sung, you know, I always know it as Mary's crap song first. And it's a beautiful song. I think it's called Umphamwifu or something. But that's kind of my theme song. It's got a lot of gravitas, the song, and it's even funnier when it's gravitas done badly.
Now, I'm wondering, I know that I've watched Pride and Prejudice with the chickens nearby, so I'm sure that if I say, please could you sing the Mary Bennett song that she sings really badly at the piano, let's see if they can guess which one it is. Oh, and there they go.
Oh, that's so cool.
So there you go. Now you have kind of gravitas done badly and chickenized.
That's the best thing that ever happened.
Yeah, there's not enough chickenized bad gravitas in the world, quite frankly. Let's have a look. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. So I'm going to have to fish out the last custard cream for Kevin, for you to take. And, he's actually nibbled the rest of the cake. I don't think there's going to be any cake to take with you, I'm afraid.
Kevin!
I just wanted to say it's been so lovely to talk to you today. And thank you so much for dropping by to the Checkerboard Palace.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here and to see you. And this place is incredible. I hope we get to come back someday.
Yes, I hope so too. Well, Latimer will show you the way out. I understand he's arranged some sort of transport for you to get back to the bridge that had that strange portal thing. But I tend not to worry too much about how we get to these places. I just let Latimer organise it. But he's arranged transport for you, which I think is outside.
It's been a most surprising journey. Thank you very much.
Well, take care now, and I hope to see you at some point over the summer.
Me too. Thank you very much.
Okay, then. Bye.
Bye.
This way, Mum.
That really was the most spectacular outfit. And that cape, Latimer. All of the colours.
Yes, Mum. Most unfortunate.
There's nothing unfortunate about looking magnificent, Latimer.
Indeed, Mum. Unless you happen to be here.
Nonsense. Come to the window and look at that incredible cape sweeping across the white snow. In fact, I think it's the only colour I've seen since we've arrived here. It's so sparkly. It looks like the air is shimmering around her.
That's the colour sprites, Mum. They're in the process of trying to eat her.
Latimer, is that why you insisted I wear this outfit?
Indeed, Mum.
And it didn't occur to you to warn our guest?
How was I to know that Ms. McIntyre would arrive wearing a multicoloured cape and riotous hat?
Everyone knows about Sarah's hats, Latimer. They're the stuff of legend. In fact, did I not remark over breakfast at Worldcon that I was looking forward to seeing Sarah's hat?
Oh, that Sarah McIntyre.
Oh, well, we have to do something. Philip Reeve would never forgive me if I let sprites eat Sarah.
They won't eat her entirely. Just strip the colour from her clothes and soul. Of course, she will never be able to perceive colours again, but it isn't what I'd call disastrous.
She's an illustrator.
Oh, that's Sarah McIntyre.
Oh, wait. She's pulling a ribbon on her cloak. Oh my, she's exploded. There are feathers everywhere. Oh, this is terrible.
It was a very dignified explosion.
I think we might need to use the time machine again.
Ah, yes. As we did to undo the tragic demise of Mr. Wendig.
Tragic demise? What on earth are you talking about?
Exactly, Mum.
Oh, no, she hasn't exploded. It was just the cape. The sprites are trying to capture all of the feathers. They've forgotten about Sarah entirely.
She appears to have produced an ironing board from her handbag. Whilst I do respect a desire to be well presented, it hardly seems the right time.
That's a snowboard, Latimer. She's using it to escape. That's a bit of luck.
Yes, most fortunate, Mum. I should have checked the handbag.
Well, time for us to go, I think. While Latimer clears away the tea things, I'd like to raise my teacup to Sebastian, Hisham and Richard, the newest members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order and discover how Latimer became my butler, go to www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy. Find us another tea there, would you, Latimer? Perhaps somewhere more colourful.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.tandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/tandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.